time, the court calls 13-20-111-CV. Victor Hugo Gracia Roman versus Mirna Elizabeth Herrera. Mrs., you can start whenever you're ready.
May it please the court. The issue before this court today concerns an arbitration agreement that is contained in the party's premarital agreement that was signed on March 21st, 2014. The primary question for the court today in regards to that arbitration agreement is whether appellant waived his right to arbitration under the party's premarital agreement by substantially invoking the judicial process to the detriment of appellee. Now, of course, that question presupposes that there was a valid arbitration agreement that existed that governed the scope of this matter. I believe that that fact has not only been admitted by appellee and her counsel and the brief that they filed with the trial court in November of 2019 that appears in the clerk's record, volume one at page 346, but also in the trial court's order that denied the appellant's motion to compel arbitration in finding that appellant had waived his right to arbitration and that appellee would be prejudiced if she were required to arbitrate the dispute after more than 5 years of litigation. What we are asking of the court today is to follow state and federal law precedent confirming the strong presumption against waiver and find that appellee has failed to meet her high burden of proving that appellant substantially invoked the judicial process, one, and that two, appellant's conduct prejudiced or caused detriment to appellee. In doing so, we're asking that this court reverse the decision of the trial court in denying the motion to compel based upon waiver and immediately remand this case to the trial court for immediate referral to arbitration. What we are dealing with in this case is not an express waiver that has never been argued by either party to the suit. We are dealing with implied waiver through what has been termed as inconsistent conduct with the right to assert arbitration. Intent is the key here, and that conduct that must be presented and is appellee's burden to prove is that the conduct was unequivocal in nature. That has been consistently applied by the Texas Supreme Court and then in the sister appellate courts, specifically in Easy Pawn Corporation v. Mancius, which was a Texas Supreme Court from 1996, and also in the Perry Holmes v. Cole case from the Texas Supreme Court in 2008. What I want to focus on is that appellee's burden is a very high burden to overcome and must be considered and reviewed in the totality of the circumstances that are involved in this case. This case was originally filed, it's a divorce case out of Hidalgo County, and was originally filed
I want to stop you right there because I want to talk about the standard of review before we talk about I think we will all agree that it's a totality of the circumstances and a review of the fact basis of this case compared to what the factors that the Perry versus Cole case gives us. So what is the standard of review that we need to look at when the trial court made a decision that your client waived his right to arbitration because he proceeded into litigation?
It would be a de novo standard of review, Your Honor.
So we don't take into account that he, as a fact finder, because I believe this was Judge Gonzalez, believe that since he put the parties on notice early on in the first hearing, like we're going to decide this issue now, gave him limited discovery, and then we went 33 more months instead of just the couple of months he gave him to do some limited discovery into consideration in deciding this issue on a discretionary credibility or discretionary review?
I do not believe so, Your Honor. I believe that we are specifically doing this as a de novo review and that this court is tasked also at reviewing the totality of circumstances involved in this specific case. When we review the totality of circumstances,
do we take into account the hearing that took place when the first motion to compel arbitration was implemented and the judge gave them specific instructions like, if you're going to urge this now and allow limited discovery. And then it seemed like discovery went on. I think we could all agree that went on for 33 more months instead of a couple of months and went on beyond what was proposed during that initial hearing. Is that something we can consider under the totality of circumstances?
Absolutely, Your Honor. I absolutely believe that that initial hearing should be considered in the totality of circumstances, but also what should be considered is the great length of time that this case remained dormant. We have a case that has existed from the time that the case was filed until the order denying the motion to compel, a total of 67 months. During that 67 months, the case remained inactive for 45 months. That's over two-thirds of the time that this case has been pending. The Texas Supreme Court stated in G.T. Leach v. Sapphire and also in Perry v. Holmes that you cannot have, waiver cannot be implied by inaction. It must be by unequivocal conduct. So for two-thirds of the case, there was no action done by either party in this case. In regards to-
But counsel, your client, it wasn't just inactivity, but what I'm looking at is activity. For example, your client included his deposition being taken. Don't you think that substantially invokes the judicial process? Because that occurred months and months after the court had said 45 days for discovery, I want to rule on this motion. And then a motion doesn't get re-urged till, that was in 2016, it doesn't get re-urged until May of 2019. In the meantime, there is substantial discovery that occurs well beyond the time period that the court allowed discovery. How do you respond to that?
And yes, and to the point of the deposition was actually ordered to be taken by the trial court. I understand that the trial court said that limited discovery would happen until the hearing could be re-urged on August 15th, 2016, but the deposition of appellant was ordered to be taken by the court, and there were specific parameters that it was not going to occur in certain locations near the border, and that was going to be accommodated. So I believe that deposition occurred in accordance with that order. As to the discovery, the only evidence that was that appears in this record that the trial court specifically stated it was relying upon was that, and that appellee introduced into evidence, was one request for production and the deposition of appellant. There has been ample case law in the Texas Supreme Court and in the appellate and then the sister courts that have stated that such limited discovery would not be inconsistent with the right to compel arbitration. In the Vesta Insurance case, the Texas Supreme Court specifically noted that the failure of Cashin in that case to actually present evidence of the discovery, to introduce the discovery request, the discovery responses into evidence, created a situation whereby the court could determine whether the discovery was limited or extensive in nature, whether the discovery went to the merits or to the arbitrability provisions, or whether the discovery would have been useful in arbitration. All that we have in the record before this court, for the court to determine the totality of circumstances, is one request for production and appellant's deposition. And I want to point the court to the hearing that occurred in 2019 regarding the motion to enter orders based upon the June 30th, 2016 hearing, which was the initial hearing on the motion to compel arbitration, when the court specifically stated that it was only going to consider discovery after August 15th of 2016. And when I say that the only evidence that was adduced by appellee at the trial court level regarding discovery was that one request for production and the one deposition, is because those are the only.
ML, I hate to interrupt you, but I thought also in reviewing the record, we had evidence that parties entered and extended restraining orders, that the deposition of somebody's parents were taken. Isn't that all before the court in regards to that?
Your Honor, the only evidence before the court regarding the deposition of the parents was not that they were taken, but that letters had been sent by counsel for appellant to counsel for appellee requesting dates for that deposition and stating the intent to take those depositions. Those depositions never actually occurred. So
even though he's trying to take depositions, they're not occurring because I understand there was a motion to strike or to stop those depositions. Isn't your client, though, by requesting the depositions, by agreeing to restraining orders, in and itself evidence? Now, whether it's sufficient or not, whether evidence or not, that he is initiating, trying to take part of the judiciary, and not arbitration. I mean, why ask for him?
I can't answer the question as to why I asked for them other than the fact that there was a claim of fraud. There was a claim of fraud, and the question became as to whether fraud was in the inducement to the entire premarital agreement or fraud was in the inducement to the arbitration agreement, which specifically has to occur for the arbitration agreement not to be applicable in this case. There were many claims made by Appellee regarding fraud and the inducement to the premarital agreement, but even Appellee admits in its trial brief to the court that there was no evidence adduced as to fraud relating to the arbitration agreement, and therefore, if the court found that there was waiver, the issue of fraud would be tried in the trial court. However, if the trial court had not found waiver, the issue would have actually been tried in arbitration. So I do believe that a lot of the discovery that was done, including even the expressed intent to take certain depositions, were all defensive in nature and designed to specifically address the fraud claims that had been alleged by Appellee.
If she's trying to avoid the agreement as a whole, because she's saying there's fraud and inducement in her signing it, then that would also defeat the arbitration clause because the arbitration is contained in that initial prenup, isn't it?
Well, according to Forest Oral Company v. McAllen, which was a Texas Supreme Court case in 2008, the court specifically stated that the fraud must relate to the arbitration agreement itself, and it's not sufficient to simply introduce facts regarding fraud as to the entire premarital agreement. Even if there is a contract that is considered void, there have been cases that have stated, which includes the American Homestar of Lancaster case from 2001 in the Texas Supreme Court, that even if the entire contract was void, that the arbitration agreement could still stand. So I don't necessarily believe or think that the case law supports the presumption that adducing evidence as to fraud relating to the entire premarital agreement constitutes fraud in signing the arbitration agreement.
Oh, well, let's assume that we agree with you that it should go to arbitration. Would that mean that she was waiving her fraud claim as to fraud in the inducement and to trying to declare the underlying prenup a void based on fraud? Or is that lost?
No, I believe that is a claim that would get tried to the arbitrator, and I believe that is within the scope of the premarital agreement itself. When Article 17 of the premarital agreement governing arbitration specifically encompasses the validity, the interpretation, and enforceability of the premarital agreement. That would certainly go to validity, and it would certainly go to enforceability. And so those issues, she's not waiving them, and they would certainly be ripe for the arbitration proceeding. I want to address the issues regarding the substantial invocation of the judicial process, because that seems to be questions that have been requested of me. And what I specifically want to point to is the fact that there have been no affirmative claims made by appellant in this in this case, other than the counter petition that was filed shortly after the August 15th, 2016 hearing. And the only affirmative claim made by appellant at that time was that the premarital agreement be enforced in its entirety. The enforcement of the premarital agreement in its entirety would include the arbitration provisions. At no point has appellant sought summary judgment on the merits of this case, sought anything related to the underlying merits of this case. The only other actions other than filing for the motion to compel arbitration were a motion to quash deposition, which the Supreme Court has specifically stated does not amount to waiver of arbitration and trying to resist discovery. That was cited by in the Perry Holmes v. Cole case. Additionally, finds that substantial invocation of the judicial process occurred on behalf of appellant. I believe that the record reflects that appellee did not meet her burden of showing that prejudice resulted from the same. There is nothing within the record that indicates the amount of fees that that appellee incurred as a result of the actions initiated and commenced by appellant, which is very key to this case. It's not the actions taken by appellee, but the actions taken by appellant that would have to cause prejudice to appellee. And so even if this court finds that there was substantial invocation, I do not believe that there's anything within this record to actually support that prejudice occurred to appellee as the result of appellant's conduct.
All right. Thank you very much.
May it please the court. Thank you for appearing, allowing us to appear in this way for argument. It's nice to be in court for a change. I want to start with the issue that was raised earlier about assuming that there is a valid arbitration agreement. We do not agree that we assume that there's a valid arbitration agreement. Certainly there was one that was signed, but we have taken the position from the beginning that it was fraudulently induced and that there was a conspiracy between the company that is the third party in the case, HNY, which Victor was the CEO, the principal, as they admit in their pleadings, and the sole owner. And we allege, of course, there's a conspiracy between the two of them. I think it's important to note that the last pleading of the plaintiff was filed in the third amendment in July the 29th, I think, of 2016. And it was just before the hearing that was scheduled by Gonzalez for the 15th of August, which was all discovered was supposed to be completed. The discovery that was outstanding had been completed as of that time. The only thing that was being requested was the deposition. That's when Mrs. Victor's first lawyer filed a motion to withdraw. He was basically represented her for 2 months. He filed a personal answer, agreed to temporary restraining order, agreed to extension of the temporary restraining order. Then he filed an amended answer in which he sought to enforce the prenup and file a motion to compel. In July, Judge Gonzalez had the hearing and said, I'm going to allow you to clean up your pleadings, and you have time to prepare to argue against the arbitration agreement, because that's an issue that needs to be taken up further. And it's the purpose of arbitration agreements. If you're going to stand by the arbitration agreement, then we need to visit that as soon as possible. And he said, we're only going to do limited discovery through the 15th of August, as has been talked about. Mia was hired when the other lawyer withdrew, and he took a vastly different stance. He abandoned, it's our position, he abandoned the first motion to compel arbitration, and he filed an answer on behalf of respondent and third party respondent. They answered the petition and counter petition, and they said both Victor and another counter petition or divorce. Also sought to enforce the prenuptial agreement and to for affirmative finding related to the status of property related to the divorce.
Counsel, I couldn't hear. What affirmative pleadings do you say he filed, counsel? Would you repeat that?
Yes, he filed at CR page 133. He filed a respondent and third party respondent's answer to the third amended petition and counter petition for divorce. And the language in that counter petition states that both Victor and H&Y file their counter petition for divorce. And then they seek affirmative relief from the court by seeking to enforce the prenuptial agreement. And he doesn't mention the arbitration agreement in this pleading. He says he wants to enforce the prenuptial agreement in all of its provisions. And obviously the arbitration agreement is a part of that petition, but he doesn't mention it. He never mentions it in the 32 months that he represents the client. Further, he filed a motion to set aside the defaults that we obtained against H&Y. And in that, he represented that Mr. Gracia is the principal and that defendants, plural, ready for trial. And so he took the position in the first pleadings that he filed jointly for the two defendants that he wanted affirmative relief. He then filed a motion to set aside a default and represented to the court that he was ready, that they were both ready for trial. It is a pleading on behalf of H&Y, but it's the same lawyer, and he's answering for both of them in one motion and in the other, in one instance, and in the other instance, he's filing a motion to set aside on behalf of both of them, really, because we pled that there's a conspiracy between them and that one was the alter ego of the other. So
I clearly, counselor, the corporation was not a party to the arbitration or to the prenup that encompassed the arbitration.
Exactly. And the third party has never filed a motion to be included in an arbitration. So if the court were to reverse this and to say, no, Hugo Gracia has a right to arbitration, then we're left with H&Y in the underlying case, because they've not asked, no party has asked that part of the case, but
so basically the same parties are Victor acting as the principal of the corporation would have to litigate the same issues in two different venues.
Exactly.
If we were to disagree with the trial court. Okay, let me ask you a question. You know, as we all know here, you know, Texas law heavily favors arbitration. But there have been exceptions. And for example, the Perry Holmes case, where they found waiver. How is this case more similar to Perry than to GT? What is it, Leach, the other case? Can you talk about that?
Thank you for that question. Perry Holmes says, look at the totality of the circumstances, and cases list a list of guideposts of things to look at. In this case, we have a circumstance that's not present anywhere else, and that is where we have first a motion to arbitrate, to compel arbitration, and then a new lawyer comes in and goes in another direction. And he undertakes discovery. He sends four sets of discovery. The question, the counsel mentioned that we didn't put into evidence all of that discovery, but we did put into evidence 50 requests for production for all of her medical, all of her financial records, including income tax statements for 6 years. And he was asking her for a birth certificate from Mexico when he knows that she's a citizen of the United States, and he's trying to prove a fraudulent birth certificate in Mexico to put you know, aspersions on our client. It's a very aggressive posture that he took in this litigation.
Did that discovery go to the underlying issues of the divorce, those 50 discoveries? Because one of the things that Perry teaches us in GT is a discovery going towards arbitrary issues as to whether to arbitrate or not, and to underlying merit cases.
Right. This is the underlying merit because it has to do with the division of property that they're pleading a counter in their counterclaim. They're seeking to enforce this arbitration agreement's provisions related to property. And we're saying, look, the agreement that was signed in front of her lawyer is not the agreement that she went in front of his lawyer, is not the same agreement that she looked at when she was talking to her lawyer, because it included an arbitration agreement she didn't even know was included. And it included provisions that her property was listed in his schedule of property as well as in her schedule of property. So would have never agreed to such an agreement, which provides that he gets her property as well.
Yeah,
as
I noticed that in the schedules that there were overlapping properties that assumed that they were already jointly owned. And I don't really know, but I found that curious that they had overlapping assets at that point.
We think it's evidence that she didn't sign the agreement that she was going over with a lawyer that she asked to review the agreement with. The other thing is that there were 32 months. This lawyer, Quintana, represented Victor for 18Y for 32 months. During that time, he never asked for a hearing on the previous filed motion. He never filed a motion to compel arbitration himself. And he continued to press discovery, including four sets of requests for production. There is a lot of evidence in the record about discovery that has occurred because there were certifications of discovery filed in the record that we've recited and we've referenced in our brief that are all set out in the court's docket. And of course, the court took the judicial notice of the complete docket of the case, which included the briefs that were filed by each party, and which includes the statement by me as counsel, the representation to the court that our client had incurred $30,000 in attorney's fees in responding to all of this discovery that was required to be answered by the aggressive, not just defense, but prosecution of their position that this prenuptial agreement is.
Mr. Hendrickson, you talk about, let's go right back to that, because that was the issue that Mrs. Amel brought up about that there was no evidence of you showing any substantial harm. But what you're telling the court is that there's an affidavit presented by you that states that there was attorney's fees and expenses incurred on behalf of Mrs. Herrera?
No, ma'am. No, Your Honor. I included that information in the brief that we submitted as a representation to the court. It was not made upon.
Okay.
And counsel, but wouldn't that have been discovery that would have still have been conducted, whether it wasn't to present your case in front of either a judge or an arbitrator? How does this whole discovery process that occurred serve to prejudice you or cause you harm?
My experience with arbitration is that it's an accelerated process and a limited process. And in this, the arbitrator would never have allowed all of this voluminous discovery in documents. 6 years of documentation, and it was not just to prove my client's case, but it was also for his for the his benefit in trying to prove his case for enforcing a prenuptial agreement related to the property. They also state that it's evident on the record that prejudice is evident on the face of the record if you consider the entire record, all of the docket sheet and all of the documents that are filed that the court took the notice of, and the fact that he had advised the counsel that we were going to decide this arbitration question early if he wanted to press it. When they didn't, and the new lawyer changed directions, it became clear to all of us we were going to try it to this court. Attorneys are not free, and the cost of responding to this is evident. Certainly, there's a difficulty in determining what work is done in prosecution of a case and what is done in defense of a case. But certainly I think the court would agree that equal time is required to both prosecute your case and to defend against the other case in this situation. It's not reasonable to assume that all of the work that was done by the defendant was just in of his case. Of the case that we were pleading, but it was evident from his pleadings and his request for affirmative action and affirmative relief that he was prosecuting his case to shut out her completely on any property in the case. He was asking for a divorce on his terms. That's the affirmative action that he was seeking. It's an unusual case in the sense that it's a divorce case, and we all know that you don't have to counterclaim for divorce. When he counterclaimed for divorce and sought additional relief, that's when he's invoking the jurisdiction of the court. Unless there's no other questions, I'll be back.
Right. Justice Tejerina, Justice Hinojosa?
I got nothing. Right,
we're going to take your 4 minutes back. Okay, thank you. We'll take your 4 minutes back, Mr. Hendrickson. Thank you for giving us back 4 minutes this afternoon. Ms. Emel, you have 5 minutes on the clock. You can proceed whenever you're ready.
Yes, Your Honor. I would like to respond to Appellee's discussion about Perry Homes and how this is similar to this case. And I would like to show the court how Perry Homes is very much distinguishable from the case at hand. The Perry Homes case v. Cole involved a situation where the Coles had actually vehemently opposed arbitration from the outset of the case and had filed a 76 or 79 page brief actually opposing the arbitration in that case. There were also 10 depositions taken within the context of that case. That does not exist here. There were 5 motions to compel discovery that had been actually prosecuted and issued by the Coles in that matter. And there was extensive discovery about nearly every single aspect of the case within the Perry Homes case. None of those factors actually exist within this case. Mr. Hendrickson pointed to the request for production that is part of this record. And if the court would refer to that request for production, which is in volume 8 of the reporter's record and plaintiff's exhibit 3 of that record, the first 39 requests of the request for production are specifically asking for production of documents related to the specific claims filed by Appellee within her third amended petition for divorce. As such, they are defensive in nature. The remaining requests govern financial documents which would be relevant to the fraud analysis as it relates to the premarital agreement, wherein Appellee had specifically stated that she had contributed hundreds of thousands of dollars to appellant and to his separate property corporation, H&Y Limited, which was actually added as a third party respondent to the suit. So the request for information would be information that would be relevant during the arbitration proceeding and does not contain any request that would have been any additional information to which either party would not have been entitled at the time of arbitration. As to the prejudice, as I stated before, I believe that the record is completely devoid of any evidence of prejudice to Myrna as a result of Victor's actions. The Appellee's counsel argues that prejudice can be inferred from the entire record as a whole. However, for 45 months, this case remained inactive. I do not believe when you have a case where it's been inactive for a significant period of time and no action has been taken in the trial court during 45 months, which is over two-thirds of this case, that prejudice can be inferred from the record of the court. Moreover, that has been in G.T. Leach. The Texas Supreme Court said that 18 months of active litigation was not sufficient in order to constitute waiver. Moreover, Vesta Insurance Company said that 2 years of active litigation was not enough to constitute waiver. Here, when we've got 45 months out of 67 months of inactivity, that leaves 22 months, which actually is less than the 2 years that Vesta Insurance, specifically Vesta Insurance, where the Texas Supreme Court stated that it was not sufficient to constitute waiver or prejudice to the other party. The fees that have been alleged to have been incurred by Appellee due to the prolonged and extensive discovery in this matter have been largely self-inflicted. The record contains evidence that Appellee sent multiple requests for production via the certificates of discovery that were entered into evidence, lodged numerous claims to which appellant and third-party respondent H&Y Limited had to respond, added a third party, H&Y Limited, and engaged in extensive discovery. A mere reference to fees that may have been incurred without more is simply not the kind of prejudice that the Texas Supreme Court and the federal courts have found necessary to clear the high burden of waiver in this case, which is why we are asking this court to find that Appellee has not met her burden to prove both prongs of waiver, which amounts to substantial invocation of the judicial process and prejudice as a result of Appellant's actions.
All right, is there any further questions? If not, this case is under submission.